Next up, we have Karen Pazel. Karen serves as the lead scientist for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Abortion Surveillance System. She also contributed to the forthcoming CDC OPA recommendations for providing quality family planning services and has played a lead role in developing surveillance measures for monitoring the impact of these new recommendations. So she's going to discuss using surveillance data to monitor the nation's reproductive health. Karen.
All right, let me... Okay, so thank you everyone for coming out this morning. Now that you've heard an overview of CDC and OPA's efforts to develop new recommendations, I'm going to talk about our concurrent efforts to develop surveillance, standard surveillance measures to monitor our efforts. But first, I have no financial relations to disclose. And importantly, I want to thank all of my co-authors up here on the top for helping me with this presentation, as well as the numerous people who have provided input and critical feedback during the process of our development of the measures that I'm going to talk about today. So as I mentioned, in concurrence with the developing the new recommendations, we've been working on the development of standard surveillance measures so that we would have a baseline measure right with the release of the new recommendations. Our initial surveillance reports will focus on differences by income, given the relevance for evaluating the need for and impact of publicly funded services. But in addition, we plan in the future on a periodic ongoing basis to release additional reports that will contain more demographic variables as well as insurance status so that we can evaluate the impact of the Affordable Care Act. So in line with the structure of the new recommendations, we have developed surveillance measures in a broad range of outcomes. They've been organized for the surveillance report into four broad categories. Outcomes related to contraceptive services for persons who wish to delay or prevent pregnancy. Infertility services for women and couples having difficulty achieving pregnancy. Testing, treatment, and counseling for HIV, AIDS, and other STDs, and preconception health services for women who are trying to become pregnant or may become pregnant unintentionally. Now, within each of these four categories, we have three different levels of surveillance measures. The first level is our targeted health outcomes, unintended pregnancy, infertility, HIV, AIDS, and STDs, and conditions that hinder optimal preconception health, diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, anxiety, and depression. Then at the next level, we have measures related to risk and protective behaviors that either lead to or prevent our targeted health outcomes. And finally, at the last level, we have surveillance measures related to the use of relevant healthcare services that influence these risk and protective behaviors. So very briefly for the methods, I've listed our data sources and our target populations. For our initial surveillance reports, we primarily use two data sources, the National Survey of Family Growth for contraceptive services, infertility services, STDs, and HIV prevention services and related outcomes. For preconception health services and related outcomes, we have relied on the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, or PRAMS. And briefly, the populations included in those surveys, NSFG, persons of reproductive age, 15 to 44 years, for PRAMS, that is women who have recently had a live birth. And for a few analyses, those related to infertility, and for analyses that are stratified income, we have restricted our measures to persons age 20 and over for infertility due to the relevance and for income due to the greater reliability of income reporting among adults. So for the rest of the presentation, I'll go through each of these categories of services. I'll start with a brief overview of the health impact related to our the impact and burden related to our targeted health outcomes. And then I'll briefly go through our surveillance measures related to risk and protective behaviors and service utilization with a focus on differences by income. So for the first category, unintended pregnancy and use of contraception. Just a brief overview of the burden. Teen unintended and closely spaced pregnancies are associated with adverse maternal and child health outcomes, such as delayed prenatal care, premature birth, and negative physical and mental health for children. In 2006, there were over 3.2 million unintended pregnancies, or 49% of all pregnancies in the United States. And in 2008, over 750,000, or 7% of all female teens aged 15 to 19 years became pregnant. So unintended pregnancy is largely preventable through the use of contraception, especially the most effective forms, including surgical sterilization for persons who have completed their desired childbearing, and long-acting reversible contraceptives are LARCs, including IUDs and implants. This slide here shows the current prevalence of contraceptive use among women at risk for unintended pregnancy in the United States, defined as women who are sexually active, having had intercourse in the 3 months leading up to their interview. They're not pregnant or trying to get pregnant, and they're not sterile by means other than a contraceptive operation, such as tubal ligation or vasectomy. So as you can see from the slide here, we have a great deal of room for improvement. Only 37% of women are using one of the most effective methods, and only 5.5% of women are using the long-acting reversible methods. On the other hand, you can see that we still have 12% of women who are not currently using, who are at risk but not using any method. So this slide here shows current contraceptive use stratified by household income, and you can see that there are differences by income level. Looking at surgical sterilization, you can see that there tends to be a decline in the percentage of women across income categories who are relying on this method. LARCs, as you can see from the last slide, are the use is low among women of all income levels. On the other hand, use of some of the other effective methods, such as pills and injectables, is highest among women in our top income category. And if you look on the very right, the use of no method at all is highest in our lowest income category. Moving now to infertility and the burden and use of related services. Infertility is defined for couples as lack of pregnancy after 12 months of regular unprotected intercourse. For women 35 and older, assessment for infertility often begins after 6 months. Infertility can have adverse effects for couples, including psychological stress, anxiety, and depression. In 2006 to 2010, approximately 1.9 million, or 5.8% of all married or cohabitating women aged 22 through 44 years were infertile. Now, for the purpose of our surveillance report, we've defined two levels of services that women may use for the purpose of obtaining help to achieve a pregnancy. The first category is use of advice alone, and the second category is the use of additional medical services, including infertility testing, medications to improve ovulation, surgery to correct blocked tubes, and the use of artificial insemination and assisted reproductive technology. This graph here shows the use of services to achieve pregnancy among women who are infertile, stratified by household income. As you can see, the proportion of women who are infertile who sought advice alone was quite low across income categories, but you can see there is still a wide gap by income in the proportion of women who have obtained additional medical help. Moving now to HIV/AIDS and STD, the burden and use of testing and prevention services for persons at risk. HIV/AIDS and STDs, especially if left untreated, can have many negative outcomes for the health of women and men, as well as their children. Chlamydia and gonorrhea can cause tubal infertility. STDs such as syphilis and HIV/AIDS can be passed to the infant during pregnancy and harm the newborn's health. And in 2011, among women and men of reproductive age, there were nearly 1.2 million cases of chlamydia reported. There were over 300,000 cases of gonorrhea, and nearly 400,000 persons received a diagnosis of HIV infection. Now, one of the primary prevention strategies for sexually active persons at risk for STDs is the use of condoms. This graph here shows the proportion of women and men at risk who used a condom the last time they had sexual intercourse with an opposite sex partner in the last 12 months among different groups of persons for whom condom use is recommended. This includes all sexually active 15 to 19-year-olds, all persons under the age of 20, persons 20 and older who are not in a mutually monogamous relationship, and persons of all ages who have a history of engaging in high-risk sexual behaviors, such as having five or more sexual partners in the past year, engaging in male-to-male sex, or engaging in sex in exchange for drugs or money. So you can see from this graph, while condom use is recommended among all of these groups of persons, the percentage of persons using condoms range from only 33 to 61%. Another prevention strategy for STDs is screening among persons at risk, which can also promote early entry into treatment for persons who are infected. This graph here shows the receipt of chlamydia and HIV testing among women who are at risk and are recommended for testing stratified by income. For chlamydia, testing is recommended on an annual basis for all women 25 years and younger who are sexually active, as well as for all women who are not in a mutually monogamous relationship. And among persons of reproductive age, it is recommended that they have been tested at least once for HIV on an opt-out basis. So as you can see here from this graph, chlamydia testing among young women tends to decline across income categories, is stable across income categories. For older women not in monogamous relationship, and for HIV, there also tends to be a decrease across income categories. This graph here shows STD and HIV testing among men, again, among populations where testing is recommended on an annual basis for STDs, and at least once in a lifetime for HIV. For persons at risk more often, but at least once. Here you can see there is a decline across STI categories, testing across income categories, where HIV testing is more stable across income. And finally, our last category is surveillance measures related to preconception health and the use of services for women who are trying to get pregnant or who are at risk for becoming pregnant unintentionally. The use of preconception health care is important for women to avoid behaviors and conditions associated with adverse maternal and child health outcomes. This includes diseases related to obesity, high blood pressure, anxiety, and depression. It can also help to prevent preterm birth, low birth weight, and birth defects. However, it's also important to note that services that are typically seen as being related to preconception care are very important for improving the health of women, even when they're not trying to become pregnant. They're good for overall overall health. Despite the importance of preconception care, you can see there's still a significant burden related to these conditions. 21% of women were obese trying prior to becoming pregnant in 2010. 16% were reported to have depression or anxiety, 3% had high blood pressure, and 2.3% had diabetes, all prior to becoming pregnant. This graph here shows the prevalence of health risk behaviors during the 3 months prior to becoming pregnant, and it's stratified by pregnancy intention here, among women who intended to become pregnant and among women who did not intend to become pregnant at the time. And as you can see from this graph, the prevalence of smoking and failure to take vitamins on a daily basis is much higher among women who did not plan to get pregnant, whereas the drinking of alcohol is similarly common among all women prior to becoming pregnant. This graph here shows the prevalence of women talking to their provider about various preconception health topics prior to becoming pregnant, again stratified by income. As you can see from this graph, the prevalence of talking to a doctor about various healthcare topics, such as achieving healthy weight, treating anxiety and depression, and controlling diabetes and high blood pressure, tends to decline across income categories. This graph here shows the same populations, additional outcomes, looking at the effect of smoking, effect of drinking, and taking vitamins and folic acid. Interestingly, here you can see that there is also the same decline across income categories for women talking to their doctors about the effects of smoking and drinking prior to pregnancy, whereas the prevalence of talking to a healthcare provider about taking vitamins with folic acid increases across income categories. So in conclusion, data from the National Survey of Family Growth and PRAMS can be used to monitor the use of services in the forthcoming recommendations for providing quality family planning services. Differences by household income highlight some important disparities in service provision or utilization that may be addressed by publicly funded programs. Measurement by insurance status will be important for evaluating the impact of the Affordable Care Act. And more detailed surveillance reports are also planned to focus on differences by age and race ethnicity. And with that, I'll take any questions.
By insurance status versus only by income?
Our initial reports have really focused on differences by income, and that's merely the efforts to have them released at the same time as the guidelines. As soon as possible, we do plan to release one of these more detailed reports that will have the breakdowns by insurance.
Because we found in an analysis of services to men that when they had publicly funded services, they were more likely to have STD services than when they had private commercial insurance than when they were uninsured. So by insurance status,
Yes, yes, and I actually saw that in some other presentations that I just went to today. So we definitely, it is an issue that we will follow up on in more detailed reports. Yes?
I find that the percentage that drink and then the percentage that talk to their doctors about drinking a little concerning given the severity of the effects of fetal alcohol syndrome. And so what do you do with this, what's done with this surveillance after, how's it used? Because I would think that it could be used to beef that up.
Guide intervention.
I myself have never, I'm particularly a researcher, and so I might want to defer that to someone else who has worked in a clinical setting.
So I don't know if Sue wants to jump in, but this is the first time we're using this data. We've never actually run these analyses before. So I think, to release them with the guidelines, it'll help encourage clinicians to provide those screening and advice, especially in preconception care and reproductive life planning to encourage clients to take better care of themselves or not drink, if they aren't on a method, an effective method.